From Nebraska to Connecticut, Mississippi to Idaho, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Federal Reserve has announced it will accelerate its pullback of economic stimulus measures. Christopher Russo from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University is here to explain what impact this will have on inflation. President Joe Biden's so-called Build Back Better agenda is on life supports in the U.S. Senate. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. With a vaccine and more effective therapeutics, is a return to shutdowns and long quarantines necessary as COVID-19 spikes again? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And a number of states across the country cut taxes during 2021. Was your state one? Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has details on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Federal Reserve Board met this past week and announced it is going to phase out economic stimulus measures sooner than previously announced. Runaway inflation has something to do with that. To explain how all of this works, we turn to Christopher Russo. Chris is a postgraduate research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University and previously served as a policy advisor to the Federal Reserve System. Chris, welcome to American Radio Journal. Christopher, before we discuss the actions that were taken this past week by the Fed, tell us a bit about this bond buying program that they're now planning to wind down. Why has this program even been in existence? What was it intended to do?
Thanks so much for having me on the program. I'm excited to be with you. This bond buying program by the Fed began at the start of the pandemic. They began purchasing tens or hundreds of billion dollars of mortgage-backed securities and treasury bonds every month. Treasury bonds are the debt that's issued by our government to help it finance its payments. And mortgage-backed securities, those are bonds which are based in mortgages that are issued by banks. So if you own a house and you have a mortgage, your mortgage is probably bundled up in a bond that's purchased by an investor to help to finance that mortgage. The Fed began doing these purchases at the start of the pandemic, first to help market functioning. As you might imagine, it's very important for the treasury market and the MBS market to be working well. If the markets are not working, debtors can't issue new debt, so the government or banks who are going to be issuing mortgages can't issue additional credit. So the Fed stepped in to make these purchases to ensure the market was functioning effectively and efficiently. They continue to make purchases since that time in order to support the economy. There's macroeconomic theory that says if the Fed engages in these sorts of purchases, it can have some effect at lowering long-term interest rates. And as long-term interest rates fall, that could spur investment that would be important as the economy is attempting to recover from the pandemic. And in the last few months, the Fed has started to pull back on these purchases, first making an announcement in November that they would start reducing their purchases, and now accelerating those reductions at the recent meeting.
Where does the Fed get the money to make these purchases that they use to help put some controls on the economy?
So the Fed creates the money. This is their power as the central bank. In simple terms, all of our banks have accounts at the Fed. You can think of the Federal Reserve as a bank for banks. And when the Fed purchases these bonds from our banks, they credit their so-called checking accounts, or what are actually called reserve accounts, with the money. And so as the Fed buys these bonds, the overall money supply, the reserves held by Bank of the Fed increase. And as the Fed reduces their bond purchases, those increases will decrease. And ultimately, as the Fed begins to contract its balance sheet, that increase in the supply of reserves, money held by banks, will fall.
So if you start flooding the market with more money, which is what they've been doing now since the start of the pandemic, is this one of the reasons why we're seeing inflation, which, what, is now at about 6.8% over the last month?
Depends on how you measure it, but in broad strokes, yes, inflation is running very high, well above the Fed's 2% inflation target. There's a tricky issue, though, because when the Fed buys treasury securities, what they're really doing is they're exchanging one type of government debt for another. So they're going out, they're buying these 10 or 30-year treasury bonds, and they're replacing them with, as I mentioned, a another government liability, reserves at the Fed. So this type of money printing story, when we're talking about the Fed, doesn't make as much sense as it might first intuitively seem to. It's more about shifting the financing of the government's liabilities rather than increasing the total stock of those liabilities. What the Fed really can do is increase the private creation of money by our own banks. And this is what happens when they lower interest rates, which was the primary way that they responded to the recession. The rate at which our banks can borrow overnight and other financial institutions can borrow overnight is directly controlled by the Fed, and they lower that down to zero as well at the start of the pandemic. And so as we'll see, the Fed will reduce its asset purchases over the next few months. And as we've gotten guidance from the recent FOMC meeting, policymakers are projecting that they'll begin raising interest rates as well, with 3 rate hikes in the following year, 2022.
We're taking a look then at these inflationary pressures, and President Biden at one point said that they were transitory, temporary. What are we seeing happening now? It's sort of moved already, Chris, past the transitory point. Are we to expect that we're going to have this inflation that's running at, a 30 or 40-year high rate over the first half of 2022?
Inflation of all the different variables in economics is maybe the hardest to forecast. So any conversation about inflation should start off with that. When the Fed says, or other policymakers say, that inflation is transitory, what they're saying is they have a long-run target for inflation of 2%, and they have the tools necessary to bring inflation down to 2% over the long run. They can't control the month-by-month variations in inflation. All they can do is adjust their tools as they think is appropriate to bring inflation down to 2%, and that's what we're seeing. So as inflation has run well above what I think many, including Fed policymakers, had been projecting inflation to be, they're now beginning to pull forward the first rate hikes, reduce the supply of bonds that they're purchasing. All of these things I anticipate will lower inflation back down to 2%, although it's hard to give a forecast of exactly when that would occur.
As interest rates start to rise, what sort of impact would we likely see that have on the economy? Because it'll be harder then for folks to buy a home, to get the capital, to do manufacturing or whatever. Will that cause the economy overall to slow down?
Yes, I think that's reasonable. One way to sort of put these two ideas together, and something that's been pioneered by my colleagues at Mercatus, is looking at overall national income, the total amount of income earned by people and corporations in the U.S. economy. And what we've seen during the pandemic is that first, a sharp fall in total income. And what you can think of the Fed's response as doing is bringing national income back up to where it would have been had there not been a pandemic. And in fact, in the last quarter, that's what we've accomplished. We've gotten income back up to where it would have been absent the pandemic. The way they've done that is through a combination of really two things. First is real economic growth, the type of things that people care about for improving their businesses and improving their households' bottom line, but also inflation. Inflation, rising prices, has been a way of getting national income back up to trend. In my view, the goal of monetary policy going forward should be to keep national income growing at this more moderate pace.
We have been talking with Christopher Russo. Christopher is a postgraduate research fellow at the Mercatus Center, which, of course, is at George Mason University. Chris, tell us just a little bit about Mercatus. Also, where can folks go on the web to learn more, to read your writings, etc.?
Mercatus is a research center, an economics research center at George Mason University. You can find more information about us at mercatus.org.
Christopher Russo of the Mercatus Center. Christopher, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He has been for months tracking for us legislative activity, particularly the so-called Build Back Better agenda of the Biden administration. Scott, good to have you here with us again today.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Build Back Better, Joe Manchin still not being able to come to any sort of agreement with the Biden administration. They had hoped to pass this by Christmas. Are those hopes now dashed?
Well, it appears that way. Earlier this week, you had Joe Manchin and President Biden meeting once again for a long, lengthy conversation. And what appears to have emerged from that meeting is that the two of them are just too far apart to get to any agreement on Build Back Better. So earlier this week, we saw the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer try to do a legislative pivot away from Build Back Better with hopes that he could create a carve-out on the legislative filibuster for another key element of their agenda, which is this voting rights legislation. Again, the Democrats want to try to keep the 2020 election in January 6th into the political conversation as much as possible. And so that's why we've seen Chuck Schumer sort of pivot to this legislative maneuver away from Build Back Better and toward voting rights. The problem with that is you still have another senator that doesn't want to create carve-outs for any legislation, and that's the senator we've previously talked about on the show, Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona.
Taking a look at what's been happening here, it would seem that Senators Manchin and Sinema are really, in many ways, Scott, they're frustrating the Biden administration, the left-wing agenda. But looking at the states they represent, is it fair to say that they're actually representing their constituencies?
In some ways, but I do think that in doing that, the frustration from the president all the way down to his aides in the White House that have been leading the negotiations, they're beginning to recognize that Biden is on the verge of becoming a lame duck president. We've got questions about Biden's ability to actually lead and put in the daily work that's necessary to guide through an ambitious legislative agenda. And then you've got the 2020 midterms that are hanging out there. We know right now that inflation is at a 39-year high. And those historic levels of inflation are a hidden tax on the American people. People are beginning to wake up. Biden is so unpopular right now. Kamala Harris is down in the gutter in terms of her own image. And so you've got a White House that's beginning to scramble alongside Pelosi and Schumer, who personally don't have favorability images among the American people at a high level either. So really, the woke agenda, the socialist agenda, is starting to harm the American people. And I think that folks are waking up and it's like, oh my gosh, is this what we voted for in 2020? And then you're also seeing affirmation from the right of exactly what we thought would happen and why we voted against Joe Biden and tried to support President Trump, who really had a booming economy right up to the point where the COVID lockdowns in these states began to create economic harm.
You have mentioned that the Democrats want to keep the 2020 election. They want to keep what happened on January 6th in the spotlight. This past week, they held Mark Meadows, the former White House chief of staff, in contempt of Congress. Is this another case of where Democrats, particularly on that committee, are starting to overplay their hand, Scott?
Well, it really gets into the question on whether or not a former president can invoke executive privilege related to congressional investigations. You'll remember that the January 6th Commission actually doesn't have legal authorities in statute. It doesn't have the ability to hold people in criminal contempt. What you're looking at here is basically a resolution that Congress has brought forward that's going to penalize Mark Meadows. But the bottom line is, this isn't just Democrats. There were two Republicans that have continued to be a thorn in the side of House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. And these two are really a roadblock to unity within that Republican conference. And of course, I'm talking about Adam Kinzinger from Illinois and Liz Cheney from Wyoming. The two of them are on the January 6th Commission. They were appointed by Nancy Pelosi. And at the same time, Pelosi prevented Kevin McCarthy from appointing his own Republican members to the committee. We think this is a sham committee that is only continuing to bring forth information that the media has already discussed. We all know what happened on January 6th. I don't condone any of the rioting or violence that happened. But the bottom line is, when you have a history book, there are moments in history that we will always remember and we will view as sort of down points in American history. That doesn't mean that we can't turn the page and learn from those lessons. I think that a lot of people want to look forward to a positive agenda, and what the Democrats are putting forward is not a positive agenda when it comes to the economic health, the pocketbook of the kitchen table. Folks are beginning to struggle. We know that labor force participation is way down. People are dropping out of the workforce because unemployment in many cases does pay people more to collect a check at home than to actually show up for work. The local fast food chains are having a hard time filling jobs. Some of these places have to offer $20 to $200 an hour in order to get workers to accept a position. They're offering hiring bonuses. These aren't the economic incentives that lead to a healthy economy. Ultimately, you want people learning new skills and being able to create a strong middle-class foundation.
Scott Parkinson, who of course is with the Club for Growth. Scott, typically we end with you telling us a little bit about the club and your website, so let's do that again.
The club is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. If anybody wants to check us out, the website is clubforgrowth.org, and you can join those members in becoming a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
COVID-19 cases are again on the rise, but Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine says how we deal with the latest surge should be different from what we have done in the past.
What the major professional sports leagues in America decide to do in the next few days or weeks will play a significant role in how Americans view the next stage, what we hope is maybe the final stage, of the COVID-19 pandemic. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're trying to digest a little bit of the latest COVID news. The Omicron surge seems to be arriving in the United States. And it is at least somewhat concerning as cases and hospitalizations rise across the country. But I think it's helpful to look at this maybe in a sort of microcosm way, to look at the way that professional sports are handling it. And so I think it's interesting to take a look at what happened this past Monday night, for example. On Monday night, just before they were about to take the field against the Arizona Cardinals, several players on the Los Angeles Rams tested positive for COVID-19. Among them were star cornerback Jalen Ramsey and starting tight end Tyler Higbee. And under the NFL's pandemic rules, all five of them were forced to sit out of the game. By the end of this week, the Rams situation was no longer much of an outlier. In fact, the NFL has now seen dozens of positive tests this week, more than 50 on Tuesday alone. The Washington football team has more than 15 players who have tested positive and who may be sidelined for Sunday's game. The Cleveland Browns have as many as 13 players out. The Rams outbreak is now up to 18 players and counting. The National Hockey League has already postponed several Calgary Flames games after more than 20 positive tests among players and staff. And there are teams all over the NBA that are reporting everywhere from 2 or 3 to up to 10 to 12 positive tests at the moment. So we're not really sure what's going to happen here. But this is in some ways sort of a callback, right? I mean, for many Americans, the moment that COVID got real, and speaking here very personally for myself, the moment that I realized COVID was going to be a big deal was the night of March 11th, 2020. That was the night when the NBA abruptly canceled a single game and then just a few hours later announced that it was suspending its whole season after a positive test from Utah Jazz forward Rudy Gobert. This week, it seems like sports are once again kind of serving that proxy for a culture-wide reckoning with what has become a frustrating and now seemingly inevitable seasonal surge of COVID cases. And as I said at the top, what the major professional leagues do in the next few days is going to play a significant role in how Americans view the next stage of the pandemic. So what should be done? Look, the NFL, the NBA, the NHL are in some ways victims of their own success. Lucrative television contracts meant that all three were highly motivated to get back to playing games, and that meant they implemented testing and isolation protocols to protect players and coaches as best as possible. When vaccines became available, the leagues and their players' unions pushed for widespread adoption. The NHL, for example, claims that just 4 players in the whole league are not vaccinated. And the NFL has a league-wide vaccination rate of over 94%, which is significantly better than any U.S. state. So overwhelmingly, people are vaccinated. Professional athletes, coaches, staff are vaccinated. But despite those vaccination rates that are the envy of just about any corporation or community in America, these major leagues are still subjecting players to routine testing. In fact, both the NBA and the NFL recently imposed heightened testing protocols. That means more tests, more frequently for more people. And unsurprisingly, they're getting more positive tests. In fact, most of the NFL players who have landed on COVID lists this week are reportedly asymptomatic. They may not even have known that they were sick if it wasn't for all this very rigorous testing. Now, more testing is, of course, helpful in containing the pandemic. It's an important thing to do, but it also helps create a perception that the current surge in cases is possibly worse than it might actually be. If it's true that the Omicron variant is more transmissible, but less serious and less deadly than previous iterations of COVID, then that means everyone has to rethink their paradigms about how to respond to what is increasingly an endemic disease, a disease that we're going to be dealing with probably for years to come. As they did in March of 2020, America's Professional Sports League have an opportunity, whether they want it or not, to take a lead on this issue. So this might be a time for leagues to recognize that vaccinated, healthy athletes who are not at serious risk of negative health outcomes from a positive COVID test can maybe be allowed to play. Maybe we don't need to sit people out for 5 days or 10 days based on a single test. Now, serious cases of COVID will still occur, and players will have to take precautions when outbreaks hit their locker rooms. There will need to be league-wide protocols to ensure competitive fairness. Teams will have to find ways to comply with local, state, and national guidelines. All of that is true. But some rethinking of the existing protocols, specifically the protocols revolving around testing, should happen, and some of this is already happening. The NFL announced this week that it would mandate booster shots for team employees and coaches by December 27th. The league can't mandate shots for players without the players' union going along with it, but everyone else has to get a booster. Now, more shots and more arms can only be helpful. Everybody out there should be vaccinated, and if you have any risk at all, you should be getting a booster. But boosting an already widely vaccinated population only makes the tension with the league's isolate if you have a positive test policy all the more obvious, because we're taking every precaution we can so that even if positive tests happen, the consequences are likely to be minimal. And so the question that these professional leagues, and quite frankly, all the rest of us now have to grapple with is this: how should vaccinated people react to a positive test? Most of us are long past the lock yourself in the basement phase, at least most of us who don't live in New York City or California. Vulnerable populations like the immunocompromised, the elderly, people who can't get vaccinated for various reasons, those people continue to need protecting, but elite athletes and anybody who's in pretty good shape does not fall into that category. Those who choose not to get vaccinated don't deserve any special accommodations at this point. They're taking a risk with their own life, and they have to live with the consequences of that decision. But we shouldn't be reliving March of 2020 right now. Nearly 2 years into the pandemic, it's increasingly obvious that we will never fully escape COVID-19. This is the inevitable next step of dealing with COVID as an endemic disease. And it's a step that major professional sports leagues like the NFL and the NBA will have to take sooner or later, and they will take it before the rest of society does. They will, just like they did in March of 2020, kind of signal to the rest of us what the right course of action is here. And hopefully that course of action is significantly different from what it was last time around. But we'll have to wait and see. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm at Reason.com. You can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Several states cut taxes this year, and that has resulted in improved economic performance. We get details now from Jonathan Williams of the American Legislative Exchange Council on this American Radio Journal commentary.
2021 proved to be a big year for common sense free market policy wins, as many states took steps to increase their economic competitiveness by enacting money-saving policies and tax cuts for hardworking taxpayers. From the South to the Rocky Mountains, taxpayers in many states across the country will see more money left in their pockets this year, untouched by their state governments. Many states substantially cut taxes this year in some way or another. Some meaningful tax cuts came in Arizona, North Carolina, New Hampshire, and Arkansas, just to name a few. New Hampshire, the live free or die state, took away its asterisks on its state income tax, where it used to have an interest and dividends income tax. That was phased out by the legislature and signed into law by Governor Sununu this year. Following a narrow passage of Proposition 208 in November of 2020, Arizona's top marginal income tax rate increased from 4.5% all the way to 8%, a 78% tax increase for individuals earning at least $250,000 per year. After tough legislative battles this session, Arizona lawmakers thankfully passed a historic state budget that substantially cut taxes. The net tax cut reduces the personal income tax rate to a flat 2.5% for most Arizonans and caps the rate paid by high-income earners at 4.5%. North Carolina continues its longtime legacy of tax reform and tax relief as legislators move to lower the personal income tax and phase out the corporate income tax altogether. The personal income tax rate will now be lowered to 3.99% in coming years, while the corporate income tax will be completely phased out over the coming decade. Turning to Arkansas, a state where lawmakers just cut the top marginal income tax rate from 5.9% down to 5.1% and cut the corporate income tax rate all the way down to 5.3%. Both cuts depend on Arkansas meeting necessary revenue triggers, but however, this will be the largest tax cut in Arkansas state history. Other states have also been successful in cutting taxes this year. In addition to the states mentioned earlier, 9 other states cut their personal income tax rates this year, while a total of 7 states cut their business income tax rates. States aren't just dramatically cutting taxes, they're cutting the forms of taxes that are the most economically damaging, income taxes. Based on our work at the American Legislative Exchange Council, our Rich States, Poor States report annually highlights the benefits of states that can reduce taxes on income and become even no income tax states, where we look at the 9 states across the country, as I mentioned, New Hampshire being one that just reduced and eliminated their investment income tax. Those 9 states have outperformed the states with highest income taxes every decade in recent memory. In addition to these enacted tax cuts across the states, 2 other states came very close to eliminating their personal income taxes altogether. Mississippi and West Virginia both passed legislation in one of their state chambers that would have eliminated the personal income tax this year. Though their legislation died in the other chamber, the passage in the first shows that legislators in each state understand the huge benefits of eliminating the income tax and becoming more competitive for business growth and individual growth in their state. The number of tax cuts this year is truly remarkable, and it's a sign of opportunities taken. With the government-imposed shutdowns and consequential economic downturn in 2020, states were projected to have huge budget deficits due to a lack of tax revenue. In response, of course, Congress passed the American Rescue Plan Act, ARPA, that bailed out state and local governments. However, state tax revenues didn't suffer as predicted, meaning most states ended up having massive budget surpluses with the tax revenues plus the federal aid. Idaho, which cut its personal and corporate income tax rates this year, saw 2-year revenue growth of a whopping 35%. Nebraska and Arizona enjoyed 23% and 21% respective growth. ARPA came with the likely unconstitutional stipulation that states could not use the federal funding to cut taxes. But ironically, Congress's attempt to prevent states from cutting taxes in federal legislation didn't quite pan out the way some had hoped. It proves, though, that federal aid to states is always damaging and comes with costly strings. The great economist Milton Friedman's axiom that there's no such thing as a free lunch is once again proven true. With inflation surging to record highs and Congress looking to raise federal taxes now, we can all be thankful for the extra money that will be in all of our pockets due to the major state tax cuts in 2021. For more information on tax cuts in the states, you can visit www.alec.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KMWV-FM in Salem, Oregon, KSAK-FM in Walnut, California, along with KRBL-FM in Lubbock, Texas. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.